This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Next is, you know, sleep. Work is where you spend the most number of hours of your lifetime, which we can hate that, but it's true. And so this idea that all of your meaning and fulfillment is going to come outside of work is madness. Like, this is where we spend a huge amount of our lives. So we have to try and find meaning. We have to try and find satisfaction. I mean, 9 out of 10 people would give up a significant portion of their lifetime earnings for greater meaning at work.
That was Dr. Michelle King on Psychologists Off the Clock.
We are four experts in psychology here to bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas from psychology to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, a clinical psychologist practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado, and author of Act for Burnout, Act Daily Journal, and the Act Daily Card Deck.
From America's Heartland, I'm Dr. Emily Edlin, a clinical psychologist based in Chicago, Illinois, and author of Autonomy Supportive Parenting.
Calling in from Vienna, Austria, I'm Michael Herold, ACT coach, confidence trainer, and author of an upcoming book on being a better conversationalist and making friends.
And from coastal New England, I'm Dr. Jill Stoddard, author of Be Mighty, The Big Book of ACT Metaphors, and Imposter No More.
We hope you take what you learn here to build a rich and meaningful life.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
Small behaviors can make a big difference in our health and well-being. Most of us work so many hours each week that we should think about how our work habits affect our bodies. Being able to stand sometimes while I work has made a huge difference for me. Uplift Desks has created high-quality office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. My Uplift standing desk allows me to easily transition from sitting to standing while I work with just the push of a button. I feel so much better than when I sit all day, and it helps me recharge to change positions when I get tired in the afternoon. In addition to standing desks, Uplift offers ergonomic office seating, storage systems, even walking treadmills for your desk. You can get free shipping with no hassles, free 30-day returns and return shipping, and a 15-year warranty. Remember, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting the podcast. Visit uplifdesk.com/POTC for 5% off your order. That's uplifdesk.com/POTC to get 5% off your entire order.
We all know there are trade-offs in life, like having to drive a little further to save on gas or groceries. But when it comes to your health, you shouldn't have to trade off. So don't go back to that one doctor who's always late and rushes through your appointment just because they're close by or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, insurance, literally no trade-offs here because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. My kid's pediatrician is retiring this summer, so you can bet I will be using ZocDoc to find someone new who we all love and trust. So go to ZocDoc.com/POTC and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/POTC. ZocDoc.com/POTC.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Michael, and I'm sitting here with my favorite Debbie to talk about my interview with Dr. Michelle King on her book, How Work Works. So, Debbie, what were your thoughts listening to the interview?
Well, the main thought that I had was a little bit self-centric because, as you know, I've been working on this book on acceptance and commitment therapy for burnout for quite some time, and it's in the very final stages. And I kept thinking, I really wish I would have read this book, that it would have been available to me as I was working on the book. Because of course, at this point with the manuscript, you give it to your publisher and they stop letting you add things to it. I'm well past that point. You know, it's like Van Gogh, how at some point Van Gogh has to put the paintbrush down and just stop because you could keep dabbing paint on forever.
Yes.
Well, anyway, because there was so much overlap, I think, with the concepts in my book, but then so many really interesting ways to think about things and so much research that I wasn't really aware of about work and how we engage with work and how we make meaning in work and how we foster good relationship works. And I loved it. I thought the conversation was so great and so helpful to listen to. And I kept thinking, oh, I wish I would have had time to integrate some of this into my book, because it was really, you know, there were just a lot of nuggets to think about.
We couldn't even touch on a fifth of the topics that were in the book, like all the different informal levels she talks about, informal layers. And what I really liked about her work is that it's not anecdotal. She has great stories in there. They're easy to follow. But then you go to the end of the book and you find pages of studies that either she conducted or she referenced. And I think that it's just really important when authors put a lot of numbers and statistics into their books, then I, as the reader, at least like to see the original source. And she does a phenomenal job of blending up-to-date research with, here's an actual solution. Like, this is how you make your way out of that.
I think that's right. A lot of what she writes about and talks about in the interview makes sense, but to know that she and others are out there researching this and that there's some research basis to it too, it's helpful. And I do think the practical application is important. I think she gives some really solid suggestions for, okay, what do you do to have more meaningful work and to have these kinds of work relationships that are satisfying? And toward the end, you talk about a really important piece with her, I think, that maybe sometimes is overlooked a little bit, which is around self-awareness. And, you know, if you're at a workplace and you're working on a team or collaborating with others, it's really important to take a look at, you know, what you're doing well, where you have room to grow. And she gives some really concrete ways to do that and to think about it. And to me, that was a really important piece, because how often do people do that? Stop and spend a few minutes reflecting on how they're showing up, for instance, in a group or on a team. And I really love that idea.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you there. I think when someone lays a hand on a book like that, it's very tempting to execute on all the tactics and go after all the new things that we've learned there without checking in, like, where do I actually want to take this? Where do I want this new technique to take me? And so bringing in those personal values and then applying the techniques appropriately and checking in with oneself is so powerful. So definitely everyone listen to the end to find that nugget there as well.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of what it's all about, right? It's like, how do you have a meaningful work life? We spend so much time working. You want that to be meaningful. And at the end of the day, you want to feel proud of what you've done with your work. And so I love that concept.
So, dear listeners, listen to this fine piece of work with Dr. Michelle King. Hello, everyone. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to Dr. Michelle King. Dr. King is a globally recognized expert on inequality and organizational culture. She is the host of a popular podcast called The Fix, and she's the author of the best-selling award-winning book, The Fix, Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work. Her second book, which is the basis of our talk today, is How Work Works, The Subtle Signs of Getting Ahead Without Losing Yourself, and it came out in October. Michelle is an award-winning academic with 5 degrees, including a Bachelor of Arts in Industrial Organizational Psychology, a Master of Arts in Industrial Organizational Psychology, a Master of Business Administration, a postgraduate degree in Journalism, and a PhD in Management. Currently, Michelle is pursuing a postdoctoral research fellowship with Cranfield University in the United Kingdom. Hello, Michelle. I am so excited to talk about you. I just finished reading through your fantastic book, How Work Works, and I have so many questions for you that I wish this were a 5-hour interview or a 5-part interview series, but let's see where we take that. To give the shortest of summaries in the way that I understood how work works is that this is a book that basically says you, the reader, you think how work works, how you find fulfillment, how you find career advancement, but really you don't. You're seeing kind of the tip of the iceberg, and there is so much more that you need to know. And this is the book to tell you.
Mm-hmm. That's it. You've captured it. We should put you on TV. That's it.
What made you write that book?
So the truth is, I think everybody feels a little bit lost if they're honest when it comes to work. So we've seen quite a global trend of quiet quitting, of the lazy girl job phenomenon, of now that's morphed into the snail girl job phenomenon. I don't believe these are just trends young women experience. I think a lot of people have lost their belief in workplaces. And I think a lot of that is evident in burnout rates, in fatigue, in sort of the dissatisfaction with workplaces. And I think the challenge is, along the way, it's sort of become uncool to care about work. And what I really wanted to show with this book was that we are our workplaces. And next to, you know, sleep, work is where you spend the most number of hours of your lifetime, which we can hate that, but it's true. And so this idea that all of your meaning and fulfillment is going to come outside of work is madness. Like, this is where we spend a huge amount of our lives. So we have to try and find meaning. We have to try and find satisfaction. I mean, 9 out of 10 would give up a significant portion of their lifetime earnings for greater meaning at work. And we're not, you know, we're talking as much as people spend on housing. And I just think what most of us don't know is, you know, how do we find that meaning? Is it even possible? If you're doing a sort of a fairly administrative role, is there an opportunity to still find meaning? Does it depend on the quality of the tasks you want to take? Like, how do we know what makes for a meaningful job? And so I wanted to write this book, and I actually dedicated the second page has a dedication, you know, for anyone who wants to feel seen, heard, and valued for who they are. Because I think we all want that, right? We want to feel connected. We want to make a contribution. We want to have that contribution be valued by our workplaces. We just don't know how.
I'm so glad that you mentioned this dedication about wanting to feel seen, heard, and valued. When I read through, you have this quote again at the end of the book. And I'll actually read out the quote, because this is where the book brought me to a large degree in my understanding of, you know, work life. And the quote goes like this: I want to write a book that changes how we work together so that every person feels seen, heard, and valued for who they are and what they contribute. And how much better would everyone's life be on this planet if all of us were in that situation? I mean, the numbers that you mentioned, with 9 out of 10 people being dissatisfied and being, I think they were willing to give up, I think, 23% of their income for more satisfaction in their works and more meaning in their workplace. And given how it seems that a lot of the young people that I work with that get into work, they're driven by income, prestige, the promotion, becoming a leader. Like, those are always the big words. And in your book, you make the shift towards, well, apparently this is what we kind of think we want to go for. And it's a recipe for misery. Those are my words, not yours.
So, I mean, I think the challenge is, I don't want to take away from that. So I think we have sort of core, and I share in the book, actually, not sure what chapter, probably towards the end, but the core sort of needs most people have, right, when it comes to work. And I think, of course, you want to belong. Of course, you want to contribute. Of course, you want to be rewarded for those contributions, right? of course, you want to learn and grow. You probably also want freedom to like do your job in a way that makes sense to you. Nobody wants to be micromanaged. So all of those are fundamental needs. I think the challenge, though, is when it comes to your point, does this give you meaning? Often we only learn too late in life. Once we've got the job title, once we've got the promotion, once we're earning the salary, that while those are great rewards and obviously meet certain needs most of us have, right, to provide for ourselves or for our families, what it doesn't guarantee is that meaning and fulfillment. And what I really liked about researching, you know, I'm a researcher, so people listening to this need to understand that. I'm not here to share my opinions. I'm just going to share what data tells us about how you find meaning at work. I think when I was researching career success, the very definition, you know, too often we think it is those tangible things. And actually what research tells us is it isn't. It's really the extent to which we feel connected to our workplace. In fact, you know, the root word, the Latin word for success means exitus, means how you exit. And when we think of career success, it's not what you achieve, it's what you leave behind. It's how you leave your workplace. And like writing books like this, for me, that is my meaning. It's my way of contributing more than I criticize. It's my way of actually leaving something behind that's bigger than me. And all of us have that opportunity. And I think, you know, often we like to complicate these things, but the reality is they're quite simple. When you look at what gives people meaning, it's the connections. So the whole book, How Work Works, is really about, you know, how do you manage how you undertake your job outside of just the tasks that you complete? And all of that comes down to the informal. All of it is about the relationships we have at work. All of your meaning, your job satisfaction, how much you enjoy your workplace comes down to those connections. And investing in them, building in them, managing them affects everything from your development to your advancement to your job satisfaction, the meaning you derive from work. And in the book, like, I actually talk to how you can pay it forward in your career and doing that, how that gives you meaning. But I think what it comes down to is this idea that workplaces are more than just a place where you go and do tasks. And if you're treating it in that way, it's very unlikely you're going to be satisfied, you're going to enjoy your work, and you're going to feel connected to your workmates.
Yeah, so much there. First and foremost, I see a lot of myself in what you said. I was always fortunate that I worked in professions, careers that I really enjoyed working in. And at the same time, about 10 years ago, almost to the week, 10 years ago, I realized that the career I was in wouldn't give me that, air quotes, success feeling at the end of my life, because I knew that personally I was in a situation where I could help others. I could literally pay it forward. I could be there for others and help them improve their lives instead of sitting in my career that I enjoyed and that paid good money and that gave me a lot of like fun during the workday. And so I made that switch in investing into the meaning, into the paying forward. And so there are two themes that I would love for us to dig into. And those two themes are the title of your book and the tagline of your book. So it's How Work Works. That's the first thing I want to talk with you about. And then the subtle signs of getting ahead without losing yourself. And that is the part that speaks to finding that meaning, finding that authenticity, finding those values. Now to the first part, how work works. So like I said, I used the metaphor of an iceberg at the beginning, which I don't think worked that well, but bear with me. I didn't have a coffee when I came up with that. But really you talk about this, I don't want to say hidden layer of what's going on, but it's an informal layer. But before we go there, so there's an historical reason why our work has changed since we switched from like a manufacturing society or economy over to an informal one. Can we just start there and like disentangle the knot of how this changed over time because of the change in economy?
Yeah, I'm really glad you start there because often people don't. And I think context is really important. So back in the day, if we think about sort of when organizations first came about and a lot of the ways they were structured, you know, a lot of the policies we have in process, a lot of the hierarchies that you know, structure how work actually works, were developed in the industrial era, right, with manufacturing. So you think of companies like Ford Motor Company, and you have mass manufacturing. People go to work, they do a set of tasks, then they leave, right?
Mm.
You actually could, in that hierarchy, in that structure, get away with not talking to anybody. You could go in and just complete one task on repeat. That has gone. It has gone, gone, gone. So 83% of all jobs require some form of collaboration. Hmm. So collaboration is king. It's not what you do. It's quite literally how you do it, because you have to work with other people to innovate, to problem solve, to create. Everything you do at work depends on your ability to work with people, and increasingly with people who probably don't share your background, don't look like you, don't think like you. So advanced social and emotional skills is really important in today's information economy. So that kind of command and control, that transactional, that task-focused approach to work has definitely gone. The problem is a lot of us still work in environments where we think that that's what it takes to succeed, and it's not. And so for me, the changes that have really we've seen, and I talk about how the future of work is here now, it's not like in the future.
Yeah, it's here. Yeah, it's been here for a while.
Yeah, is the diversification of talent, the diversification of customers. So, you know, really talk to that, how even works people who don't look like you. And we also see that the rise of technology like AI automation, while it's changing a lot of jobs, it's also increasing the need for advanced social and emotional skills, precisely for the point I just shared. So even in tech roles, in some of your most advanced tech roles, you cannot get away with not working with others. And as a result, this demand for social and emotional skills is probably the number one thing people need to future-proof their careers. And all of that's happening at a time where workplaces are becoming more informal. So that hierarchy I talked about is collapsing. Only 14% of leaders believe that hierarchy actually makes sense in today's work environment. And the forecast is we're really going to see a decline of mid-level manager roles. So a lot of teams are going to be self-managing. In fact, it's predicted your coworkers are going to determine your performance reviews, your pay is there. So your ability to manage how you're working with others is going to affect your career advancement, right? And it also affects things like learning, like 75% of all learning happens on the job. So your coworkers are also your teachers. So your ability to develop is going to really depend on how much people want to invest in you. So managing how you work with others is absolutely a critical skill set. The problem is a lot of the advice people get and a lot of the sort of norms and workplaces were really established back in the 1950s. So a lot of people, when they think about this, they might be thinking of office politics or how we sort of win-lose mentality, how we stab people in the back or manipulate them to get ahead. And that might have worked in a hierarchical structure that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Knowledge. So it's about a win-win mentality and figuring out, hey, how can I advance at work without losing myself? And importantly, support my coworkers at the same time. Like, what does a win-win look like? So that was the logic behind the title and the subtitle.
Yeah, and I like that so much that it becomes very quickly obvious that this is not about backstabbing. This is not about secret tactics to influence the boss. This is more like saying, hey, look, this is how it works now. It's very much informal. It's who you know, how you interact with, how you interact with them. You tell this story of you, and you correct me if I'm wrong, if it wasn't you, but I think it was you who went to that exec meeting dinner and then didn't do the minutes. Basically, the story was that you had this big meeting where you were in touch with all the big wigs in the company, and you got invited to dinner afterwards. And you're like, no, I have to do like the work stuff. I need to wrap that up. And not understanding that this is where the magic happens, that when you have dinner with them. And yeah, so it's not about like we need to, in a Machiavelli style, influence people and backstab others. It's like, no, like this is how it works now. It's the social time. It's the getting to know people. It's the water cooler talk. It's the coffee in the kitchen. And if we don't understand that this is important, the business suffers, the company suffers, and our lives and our careers suffer.
And I think, well, the challenge also is I, again, as a researcher, really struggle with ambiguous terms like unwritten rules or office politics. Mm. Like, well, what do we mean by that?
Yeah.
What does that really look like? So saying to particularly younger generations, like, you've got to influence, you've got to persuade, you've got to collaborate, you've got to be inclusive, you've got to, yep, but what specifically are you asking me to do? So this book actually reveals what it means to manage the informal. So my own PhD research really looked at, when we talk about the informal side of working life, what are we talking about? So the how is really made up of four things, right? It's made up of your informal networks. It's made up of how you share informal information to build self-awareness and awareness of other people to understand what's going on. It's how you learn informally and develop yourself, because your organization is not going to do it. And it's also how you manage your advancement, because in today's workplace, you can't just rely on your boss liking you to get ahead. You've now got to manage your employability, right?
Yeah.
And so it's giving people the tools for doing that, because most people don't even manage their careers. And so it's really understanding, look, this is our job. We have to do it, and we can. And you actually have an opportunity to be a lot more in control of your career than maybe you ever realized by doing these four things.
So I had so many aha moments going through this book, because for whatever reason, I don't know how I pulled this off, but I seem to have done this right intuitively since I got out of university. And there was no system to my madness. I just like being in the kitchen drinking my coffee. I just like talking to people instead of sitting at the computer. And going through the techniques you write about in the book, like listing your network, which is something I hope we find time to go into as well. But I realized that with the, what, like 10, 15 roles, jobs that I had in my life, I think I applied officially for 3 of them. Everything else I kind of got because people said, hey, Michael, like, there's this role there. You would be a great fit. Can you send me your resume? I'll pass it on. And that was such a win-win. It sounds like a little bit, what's the word? Nepotistic, if I'm not butchering that too much. But it kind of made sense. It made sense for my friend to recommend me because he knew he would have Michael with him. It made sense for the company to listen to my friend because they knew they were getting someone who came with a good reputation. And it made sense for me to go through my friend because it meant that I already understood that the company was a great place to work with because I had my friend's word for it. And that was just something where promotions came. I have this one memory of I was in New Zealand working for Nickelodeon, and I had a 1-year contract, which when you're in a foreign country with visa and everything, like, there's some planning that's involved with like extending contracts. And I was called into HR office and offered to have my contract extended for another year, which they didn't do with everyone. So I didn't dare ask until I signed the contract, but I asked them, I said, look, I know that I'm not the fastest animator in the studio. I know I'm not the best. Why did you extend my contract? And they said, well, Michael, because you always come to work with a smile on your face and you talk to people and people like working with you. And for us, that's more valuable than you being 20% faster, you know, than others. Yeah. And your book kind of takes that apart. And so I was like, yeah, check. Actually, I did this.
I mean, I think it's so important because managing those connections, one of the challenges, I haven't brought it up in the book, so this is new data, but I commissioned a study of 2000 18 to 24-year-olds in the US and the UK. And I've actually just written a whole article for Fortune magazine on this, that 9 out of 10 18 to 24-year-olds, 9 out of 10, avoid social interactions at work because of increased social anxiety.
Yeah.
What we're seeing is, you know, our ability to manage ambiguity, both when it comes to tasks and when it comes to social interaction, because there's a lot of ambiguity in social interaction. You've got to pick up how somebody's feeling, you know, what's going on with them, all of that context.
And then it's changing all the time as well.
Exactly. Our comfort with that is declining at a time where workplaces are becoming more informal. And, you know, I was so shocked by that result, I really wanted to understand more, like what's happening. And I think one of the challenges is, you know, social media has made a lot of the ways in which we communicate very explicit. Like if you're dating, you're interested in dating people, you know, you swipe left, swipe right. That was very different when I was in my 20s. Like we used to go to the bar and have to pick up on social cues. Is that person looking at me? Are they going to come over? Like all of that, right? And I think the challenge is the social anxiety now is felt by younger generations who in social situations feel a bit like they're on Instagram. They feel like the whole world is watching. They feel a huge amount of anxiety. Am I getting it right? Am I being watched? Are people going to laugh? And it's just easier to avoid it. The problem is that 83% of us have to work with other people, right?
Yeah.
And so avoiding it isn't an option. And I think we really run a risk in a hybrid setting of saying, well, I like working from home, so I don't need to connect. I can get my job done.
Hmm.
And my point is, yeah, your job is not just a whole list of tasks. That's half your job. The other half is learning to work with other people to get those tasks done in the best way you can. And I think that's the difficulty, is having that mindset sort of shift in terms of what it means to work, what it means to, mm-hmm. you know, be a part of an organization.
And it's not just a shift in mindset. So this study is, please send me the link to that article. I'd love to include it in the show notes and also devour it for my own curiosity. Because a lot of people that I work with are young adults that are just getting into their work life, and a big part of what I train with them is working on their social anxiety and advanced communication skills so that they do manage to do more than just swipe left or right.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And so here's what my thinking around that goes. When you deal with social anxiety, when you deal with a lack of social skills, of advanced communication skills, you're not just looking at changing your mindset. You can't just wake up one morning and be like, yeah, I'm going to get rid of that social anxiety and I'll just be a master communicator. No, you're looking at being able to deal with all the unhelpful thoughts and emotions and self-doubt and that creeps in. It's not something you can switch off with, you know, the flip of a coin. And at the same time, you can't bring in these social skills just by making that decision. You're looking at the moment you make that realization that this is something you need to work on. You're looking at a couple of weeks, months, if not a year or two of like dedicated training around this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so the study found that most participants believe they have the social skills they need to interact. They also believe they have the right opportunities at work to interact. So it's not for a lack of opportunities or skill, according to participants, right? What they believe is that it's actually just the anxiety associated with interacting. And that comes down to a huge discomfort with the ambiguity inherent in social situations. Mm-hmm. So really, to your point, this takes a long time to, and it might always be there, right? You might always feel anxious, but it's recognizing why does that happen? So it happens because millennials and Gen Z spend on average 8 to 10 hours on social media. Social media in and of itself isn't intrinsically bad.
Is that 8 to 10 hours? I'm scared to ask. Is that per month, per week, or per day?
Okay. And I was shocked. I was like, when does anybody have time to sleep or work? I don't get it. But according to the study, what we found was, you know, that time on social media, when I was researching, well, why does this cause anxiety? it's because of the social comparison that happens. So even if you're somebody who's a bit of a social loafer and just goes on Instagram, scrolls and looks at what everybody's doing, you're actually more likely than the person who's actively posting and commenting to feel that social comparison. Mm. And we very rarely come away from that like feeling good. So there was one study that said if you compare yourself to people who are similar to you, you might come off it and feel okay. But that never really happens because people are generally worse off than us or better off than us. And invariably, if they're worse off than us, that doesn't make us feel better. Because while we're, yes, we're better than them, but it's not something that, you know, we aspire to be. So we come away, it's more neutral. But when you look at somebody who is better than you, you're always going to feel worse off. And because everybody's portraying a fake version of themselves, we will come off it feeling worse then, right? And we know this, but my point is, you know, in order to tackle the social anxiety inherent for younger generations, it's recognizing this is an issue and it's probably never going away because of the social comparison piece. So if you're a manager in a workplace who is not a millennial or not a Gen Z, you have to overinvest in providing coaching, feedback, reinforcement, clarity when it comes to instructions, being really explicit as possible with all of the feedback you're giving a person and the guidelines and the boundaries around work-life integration. Like if you look at the stats on Gen Z and their experiences of burnout, it's absolutely shocking. And all of it, 75% of their stress at work is attributable to their line leader. Right? Mm. That's my data has shown that. And that is shocking. So we've got managers who almost don't know how to manage this younger generation. There's a sense of, come on, just get on with it. What's the big deal? Just come to the drink. Why don't you want to come into the frustration?
Yeah.
And it's like, look, you've got to understand this causes people anxiety because they're not seeing the inherent, they don't see connecting as having an inherent benefit. They see it as threatening to their self-esteem.
It sounds like the line managers are almost pouring gasoline on the fire instead of water. So in that regard, let me tag on another insight that I had from your book where you talk about the difference, the need to fit in and how that is inherently problematic and the more healthy way of actually belonging. So I realize I had this big like light bulb moment when I had this like put into words for the very first time. Let's talk about that for a second. What's the problem with fitting in and how is belonging different?
So I think fitting in is this idea you somehow have to change who you are to be like everybody else, right? So for me, that's the old school world of work. That's quite literally how we ended up with the old boys club. Right? Mm. The idea that workplaces are made up of closed informal networks of white, middle class, heterosexual, able-bodied men. And it actually was like that. In some cases, it still is like that, where, you know, white men think that's what it takes to maintain power, to access power. You've just got a network of people that are like you. And when we look at connecting, one of the worst things you can do in your informal network is have it closed today. So while that may have worked in the past, that doesn't work today. So researchers have studied, you know, career success and what is the number one thing people can do to manage their career success. And if you take anything away from this podcast, take this away. It's diversifying your network, right? Connect with people. So to your point, 70% of all jobs come through informal networks. And that's because 80% of jobs are not advertised, right?
Yeah.
And we might not like that, but that's the way it is. Because when you're a hiring manager and you have a role, you're going to be thinking, do I know anybody? Do I know anybody who knows anybody?
Yeah.
And today, your career success, because you're not going to just stay with one company and climb the corporate ladder, really requires having a big, open, diverse network. So I think all of these connections, that you know, managing them is actually a way of managing and future-proofing your career advancement. And that might sound quite transactional, but that is how it works.
Yeah, that was something that you, in this exercise that I mentioned earlier that you walk us through in your book, this was a big part. Like, is that node in your network, is that actually a diverse node or is it very similar to you?
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you, if you don't mind, would you just give us a brief overview of how that exercise works and what parameters are tracked in there?
Yeah. So look, I mean, I might start at the beginning because anybody listening to this, you know, when you think of your informal network, you probably think of some weird cocktail hour where you're handing out your business cards and you probably want to avoid it at all costs. So I'm here to tell you the good news. That's not an informal network. It's actually very much formal networking,
formal, yeah,
which is not where the magic happens. So your informal network is really, if you were to write a list of anybody you go to for informal information on how to do your job, for advice, like if you're struggling with something at work, or for social support, like if you're having a bad day and you just want to share. Anyone on that list who does one or more of those things is somebody who's in your informal network. Now, generally, that could be around 12 to 20 people. It's probably a really decent size informal network. So when you look at that list, you do, the first thing you want to do is say, how similar or different are people on that list from me? Now, if you're the person who's quite extroverted, who goes out there and introduces yourself to people to try and build your informal network, the bad news is research finds you probably invested in building relationships with people who are pretty similar to you. So it's quite likely you're going to have a network that's quite similar because we like people who like us.
And also, if we're dealing with social, so sorry for jumping in here, but if we're dealing with social anxiety, which a lot of people do, unfortunately, it is easier to talk to people that seem like us. They have the same shoes, they have the same band t-shirt, they have the same whatever. Let me talk to that person because we have something in common that is going to be easy to strike up a conversation about.
Yeah. And so the challenge with that is, again, you're not diversifying your network, which is like the number one thing you need for career success. So you want to try and invest in building connections with people who don't look like you and then get those individuals to introduce you to other people who don't share your background. So you diversify through the diverse members in your informal network. So that's one thing, right?
Which, by the way, also makes life so much more interesting.
So much more interesting. I mean, my whole network is massively diverse, and it's because I've introduced people to people and people have introduced me to other people, and so we've all done this together, right? And I think the second thing, though, is recognizing you can't connect with everybody.
Yeah.
Not possible. You have limited energy, time, resources, and if you're struggling with social anxiety, like just the sheer mental load of engaging is difficult. So you have to be quite mindful about who you invest your time with. And on the anxiety front, what's really interesting, what I found interesting, is that 90% of our social anxiety at work comes through 5% of the people in our informal network.
5%.
So when I read that, I was like, no. And I tried to understand, what is that? And actually, it's not. So if you look at your list again, I want you to ask yourself a question. Does this person have my best interest in mind? Because if they do, that's what we call a mutually beneficial relationship, right? That's somebody where they've got your best interest, you've got their best interest.
Win-win.
Win-win. And the ones who don't probably shouldn't be on your list, you probably shouldn't be investing in. So that's also not going to cause your anxiety. It's the ones where you're not sure.
Yeah.
The where you're not sure, you're going to invest a huge amount of mental, emotional, and energy trying to figure out, does this person have my back?
Which would be a feasible approach if we had limitless amount of time. Like there's, you know, I don't know how someone manages to spend 8 to 10 hours on social media, but even if I had that time on top of my 24 hours a day, I wouldn't have the time to invest in all the network connections that are not mutually beneficial, and I could try to turn them around. So no, that's not where my energy goes.
Well, and I think everybody will be thinking of someone they work with that fits that category. And it does play on your mind. Every interaction, you're trying to work out, is this person a friend or foe? What is it? So you want to invest in mutually beneficial relationships. And then I think the third thing is recognizing you really need what we call loose or close connections. So in academia, what we mean by that is loose connections are people you meet with infrequently. You might just have a quick catch up, but it's nothing deep. It's nothing sort of emotionally close, right? Your close connections, you actually only need very few of those, 1 to 2, right? To feel like, hey, I'm at work. I feel connected to the people in my workplace. Loose connections matter because they give you access to job opportunities. So thinking about you now and the job opportunities you've had, informal loose connections actually will say, oh, hey, did you know there's this job opportunity opening? Or, hey, are you aware this is coming up? Or, hey, I might just give them a call. They seem like somebody who might know somebody. That's how it happens. And so one way to build your informal network is not the cocktail hour route. It's to think about if they're people you want to connect with at work, you want to pay it forward, right? So you want to think about, if we come back to what is an informal network, you need to think about what information, support, or advice does that person need? And then how do I actually offer that without them even asking as a way to build my network? So I'll give you a quick example. I have a colleague, a woman I know that I'm trying to build my network with and include her in my informal network. I had a editor meeting yesterday with HarperCollins to celebrate the launch of my book. I know she wants to write a book. So I called her up and I said, I know it's going to seem left field, but I've got a lunch with my editor. I know you want to write a book. It's a great opportunity for you to meet. Would you like to? So I opened my network up and pay it forward. And that was done with not expecting anything in return, right? Psychology of it is people want to help people who help them.
Yeah.
So she immediately said, hey, that would be great. And by the way, why don't you come to our organization? She's a part of a big corporate. She's like, we'll host an event to launch your book. We'll buy copies and do that. So that's an example of how it works. And I think if your intent is literally, I'm just giving this with no expectation on my part because I know it's what somebody who wants to be a mutually beneficial connection does, you're much more likely then to make relationships with people where they're friends and supporters for life because they can trust you.
I will also add my own example here because not everyone is connected to a big five publisher and then brings people along. But joking aside, I mean, that is an amazing opportunity that you gave someone. You paid it forward and that will be reciprocal. I'm also thinking of the times where I was in the film studio in the kitchen. I was getting a coffee and I just listened to people. They would want it to vent. They wanted to talk about their struggles. And when they talk with people in their team, they would be presented with solutions with, why don't you come in on Sunday? Why don't you this and this and this? And that was Michael holding my coffee and was just like, wow, man, that sounds tough. That sounds like a lot of pressure. And I was basically just, what I had to give was not knowledge or introductions or any like tangible things. What I could give them was my emotional support, for the lack of a better word, my ears, my hey, I'm there for you. Just let me hear it. What are you struggling with? And that also I feel like paid into that paying it forward, supporting you. I don't have much. I'm just new in this company, but what I have are 2 ears and a brain, and I can emphasize with you and support you emotionally.
That social support, that's everything, right? Yeah, I think it's a great example of just a small way you can build connections and have people trust you and help grow that informal network. And the interesting thing about this, you know, just linking it back to meaning for a second, is when you pay it forward like that, what research finds is you're going to feel more connected, right? So irrespective of what the other person feels, just by being of service to others, you feel more connected, right? And I did. So at the lunch, I felt more connected for having my friend there. But at the same time, your friend who you are supporting at work, your teammate, is going to feel more connected to you and also want to reciprocate, right? So now you're getting the double whammy of you're feeling good and they're feeling good and they're paying it forward. But research finds anyone witnessing that moment, so witnessing you supporting somebody with something they're struggling with, is also going to pay it forward to you. So it's a whammy of like, they're feeling good, and then anyone witnessing it's also feeling good, and everybody's now supporting you. So that's why it has such a positive impact on your sense of job satisfaction, meaning, fulfillment, all the rest of it.
So helping others is the secret sauce.
You
couldn't wish for a better one.
You couldn't. So you think, oh, I'm giving, right? It's taking away from me. But what you don't realize is that's actually how you give to yourself.
Yeah, beautiful. So now that we've gotten into the how do we make things good, let's get to the getting ahead without losing yourself part. And there's so much about that in the book that I don't even know where to start from, being authentic to finding that fulfillment. Let me just blandly throw it out there. How do we not lose ourselves when we're getting ahead, Dr. King?
So I think the sad thing is often, I mean, I coach a lot of senior leaders, and I think often what's sad is by the time they're leaving the organization, that's when they realize, hey, I was vice president or I was CEO of such and such, but was actually all meaningless. And the meaningful moments of connection is what I'm taking away with me. It's also what I'm leaving behind. So that they lose that, right? And I think the challenge is in knowing how to connect, it's actually about managing the impact. So what I mean by that is there's something really weird that's going on in workplaces where people are like, I want to be myself at work. Authenticity is key. I've just got to be authentic. I've got to be myself. All this research on authenticity. But what we miss is it's not about saying, hey, screw you, world. I'm just going to be myself and you've just got to accept it, right?
Because it doesn't work too well.
In all honesty, that's sort of how we got into the mess we're in, right? Where a lot of white men in leadership positions were like, we're just going to do what works for us. We're not worried about anybody else, right? So that's not what it is. It's actually to build meaningful connections, to not lose yourself. It's to think about, how am I managing the impact my behavior has, even if I don't get it, even if I don't see it? How am I creating, shaping, affecting somebody else's lived experience of work? And caring. Caring because that's, you know, recognizing that broader impact you're having. And somewhere along the way, it also became uncool to care, right? Uncool to care about other people. So I think one way to not lose yourself is really to invest it, in my eyes, is to invest in self-awareness. So I don't mean that sort of lightly. There's a whole deep section on this and how self-awareness is a starting point for building your awareness of others, for building awareness of what's going on in your organization. But, you know, 15% of people are self-aware, and we don't even know we're not self-aware because 95% of people in a Harvard Business Review study said they were self-aware, but actually only 15% of people are. And the higher up an organization you go, the less self-aware you are because the less access you have to diverse range of feedback, honest feedback. Like, people are not going to tell you the truth, right? In academia, we call it the CEO disease because it's rampant. And so I think the starting point, I would say, to not lose yourself is to recognize that self-awareness is the key to connection, right? And so it's almost accepting you're not going to be self-aware. Like, self-awareness is a practice. So your default position is it's probably unlikely you're self-aware. So you've got to work really hard to build it. So if you're somebody who's sitting there thinking, you know what, generally at work, I've got this. My behaviors have a really positive impact. My thoughts, my feelings, how I carry myself all has a really positive. You are what we call an overestimator. So it's likely you're overestimating the positive impact your behavior has. That's not self-awareness. If you're somebody who underestimates, you can probably become self-aware, but you're going to need a lot of really honest feedback to understand what your strengths are to build up some of that sort of more accurate self-perception. The overestimated, though, it's very difficult for you to become self-aware. And just having one overestimator on your team can reduce your team's performance by 50%.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Right? Nobody wants to work with a competent jerk who's not open to listening to feedback, right? It's like, I don't care. It's my way or the highway, right? People want to work with the lovable fool over the competent jerk because they're so hard to work with. So I think what we have to recognize is to not lose ourselves, to not get to a point where we don't even know how, you know, we've impacted other people at work. We've got to build our self-awareness. So there are two things people can do who are listening to this. The starting point is you can build self-awareness on your own. So you can do that through reflection. So there's one study that showed if you take 15 minutes a day for 10 days, 15 minutes a day for 10 days, and ask yourself what questions. So what worked, what didn't, what could I do differently? You can do this in the shower, you can do this when you walk your dog, doesn't matter. Ask yourself what questions, not why questions, like why did that person hate me? Why did that? I don't want any of that. No,
because you're just reinforcing what you already believe when you ask a why question. Right?
It's like totally unhelpful. So just what questions, what worked, what didn't, what could I do differently? Do that 15 minutes a day. You will increase your self-awareness by 23%. Now, at first, you might be like, 23%? That's just within 10 days. Imagine if you make that a regular practice over 30 days, right? You are really going to see the compound effects of building it. The next way to do it, though, is actually getting consistent feedback from others.
So crucial.
What I want to encourage people to think about is when you finish that presentation, when you finish the podcast interview, when you finish anything at work, just turn to the people you're working with informally. Don't make it weird. and just say, hey, what worked, what didn't, what could I do differently? And gather that information to help you understand how they are perceiving your behavior, right? And if you do that regularly enough and formally enough, you will start to build your awareness of the impact your behavior is having. And importantly, what you need to do to maybe close the gap between how you see yourself and how others see you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you keep mentioning studies, and I just want to give you 2 to 3 thumbs up. I don't like to judge a book by its cover. I like to judge it by its appendix and its notes and its bibliography. And you have a fantastic 15 pages of notes, of references and sources. And that is just an abundance of just evidence-based, real research. Like, I'm not making this up. This is not anecdotal. This is not my experience. Here's like 20 years of science to look that stuff up. So let me just thank from the bottom of my heart of putting, you know, of obliging geeks like me that want to dig into all the good stuff.
I just couldn't take another platitude book, another 7 steps to success, another get up at 4 a.m. and hustle your way through. I was like, come on, this is just, and the research, I'm sick of it. Isn't anybody else sick of it? Like, and I thought, you know what? I want to understand this. I don't have all the answers. I'm a researcher. I want to understand it. So let's look at what data tells us about how workplaces have changed, what it really takes to succeed, what really works. Like, the thing about the book that I love is there's practical things you can actually do that are going to help you feel a bit more connected and advance at work. So for me, I think that side of it really matters. There's so much noise and nonsense in the career space.
Oh, yeah.
And I think just getting down to, look, what can I actually do day to day at work to make this kind of work for me?
I always see that when I work with aspiring leaders or leaders, it's like something that we never learn. We have to pick that up through the grapevine somehow. Like, I remember when I got promoted to lead a small team, I was like, yeah, but how do I actually do that? Like, I'm literally, the only thing I have to show is that I did their work for 10 years and now I'm leading 5 of them. Like, that does not give me any of the skills, and I just totally have to wing all of that. So there are many books are needed and material to really get that into the heads of people of how this works and how we make this world a better place through our work, through our leadership, through our advancement. So thank you for providing one spectacular book on the matter. Coming close to the end of our time together, is there anything you would like to address that we haven't yet?
I have it's going to sound like a strange story. I don't know if I can share it. It's not in the book. It's actually my 3rd book I'm writing now, but I want to share it with the audience because I think it might be meaningful. So when I was growing up in South Africa, I was about 12 years old going to primary school. Every April Fool's Day, my local newspaper would publish a fake story. And I was in class in my school. My teacher stood up and read the story, not telling us it was fake. She just positioned it like this is a news story. And it was about how ostriches had learned how to fly, how scientists had expanded their wings, had given them laxatives, had done all these things to help these giant birds that are flightless fly. And she said to the class, look, everybody take 30 minutes. I want you to write an essay on whether or not you think this is true. And then at the end, she asked us to raise our hands who thought the story was true. Well, of course, I'm the only person to raise my hand. And I remember saying, and everybody's laughing, right? Like, oh, you're such an idiot. You don't know this is an April's Fool. And then she said, you know, on what basis do you believe this to be like true? And I said, well, anything's possible if we try.
Right. Good point.
Now, it actually turns out in researching my 3rd book, ostriches used to be able to fly. Most people don't know this. So they actually lost the ability to fly. When dinosaurs became extinct, they could roam freely, and they forgot how to fly. And my message to anybody is, in the same way that ostriches' environments changed and they lost the ability to fly, our environment at work has changed. And we've also lost the ability to try when it comes to work, to realize we are our workplaces. We need to invest in our workplaces, because the more we can give to our teammates, the people we work with, the more we're going to derive from that. And we've lost that ability.
And so, you know, to learn to fly again, you really need to learn how to manage how workplaces work. And that's why I've written this book. I think our workplaces have changed on us and we don't even realize it. And so hopefully people can find that helpful.
So what you're saying is that we could also just bring the dinosaurs back and that would force ostriches to fly again. So that Jurassic Park like movie series is would be a way out of this as well, because you better learn how to fly or that T-Rex is going to take care of you.
Yeah, well, that's also an option. That's always an option. Yeah, bring
okay.
them back. I hope we don't bring them back.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the Jurassic Park movies had some entertainment factors in them. And at the same time, yeah, it might. Well, we'll see. We can try. We can always try and see where it goes and then maybe stop at the Velociraptor and not bring like the big guys back. Let's see how that works.
Awesome. Okay, we ended on dinosaurs. Good one.
Thank you so much. Tell us where our listeners can find all of you on the social media, the internet, where can we find you?
So everything's on my website at michellepking.com. I also have pulled together a 52-week e-journal you can download if you buy a copy of the book. And it gives you 52 exercises, one for every week, to walk you through how to apply what the book shares in your workplace. So hopefully you can find that helpful. But everything is on my website, michellepking.com.
Beautiful. And the book is out when you all listen to this interview, because it came out the day we did this interview. So I hope, Michelle, you can get to some partying and well-deserved celebrations for the rest of the day, week, month. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And thank you for writing that amazing book that might prevent us from bringing the dinosaurs back, which something we should all aspire to. Thank you.
An unintended outcome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock. If you enjoy our podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review or contributing on Patreon.
You can get more psychology tips by subscribing to our newsletter and connecting with us on social media.
We'd like to thank our podcast production manager, Jadine Stout-Williams.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources page of our website, offtheclockpsych.com.